Welcome to our discussion segment on Jack London. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Let's get started. It's the end of the season, Joe.
It is. Can you believe it?
Yes, and also no. This year has flown by, like most years tend to do once you pass 30.
I was checking the date today again, and I could not believe again that is May 20th.
Yeah.
It is nuts.
It is. It is indeed. So I enjoyed your podcast about Jack London. It's very evident that you really enjoy his books and his writing and his just kind of messages. Yeah, his subject matter. Of all of his books, which one do you think would you call your favorite?
So it's not actually one of his books.
Oh, okay.
It's one of his short stories. To Build a Fire is probably my favorite.
Why?
I did not know it was possible to feel cold by reading a story.
Mm.
And you do. This main character in the story is in such severe cold that when he spits, it turns to ice in the air.
Yeah.
So London is able to describe that in enough detail to where you can sit there and have to wrap up while you're reading that story.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, I enjoy all of his stories, but that one stood out. And my second favorite was All Gold Canyon. And I briefly talked about that in the podcast. And interestingly enough, most people have probably seen a quick short that is that story. For all of you who saw from Netflix, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, there is a quick little tale in it about an old prospector who goes into this green canyon and finds gold. And a lot of things happen as a result of him finding it. And it's a really great story. The setting is perfectly peaceful, wonderful. It's picturesque, and then all of a sudden, this loud singing miner shows up and completely destroys all of the peace, and then there's a conflict, and then he leaves. It's as if he was not ever there, which to me is kind of fascinating.
Yeah. A lot of his stories really delve into, obviously, time in the wild, outdoors, stemming no doubt from his time in, I believe it was in the Yukon, correct?
Right, yeah.
And he uses a lot of animals in his writings. What was his experience with specifically with animals? Because he's able to bring these characters to life, give them human characteristics in a way I don't know that anyone else at that time had done. It's really not until you get to Disney and they start to, you know, make animals more human like.
Yeah.
But how did he, like, I guess how did he do that? As a writer, you would presumably have some insight into that.
Well, I don't know if I have a lot of insight. I will say that because he used dog sleds in the Yukon, there was that tie there to that. And there was a sense of, I don't want to call it jealousy, but almost of these dogs that could fully embrace their purpose. And those dogs loved to work. They loved to pull the sleds.
Yeah.
And so that was something that he actually journaled about. There was this link between their purpose and that they're still wild animals. I mean, they're able to do certain things, but outside of that purpose, you wouldn't want to have them in your house. You wouldn't want to keep them as a house pet. You would want them to stay as in shape, as wild as they are, because that wildness helps them fulfill their purpose in life.
Mm-hmm. And then give us a bit more background about his early life and how, if at all, it shaped the writings that he gave us.
Yeah.
Because a lot of classic writers, they use their own experiences. And I think that London, I'll have a question on that a little bit later, but I would say that London is definitely one of the classics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. As I said in the podcast, he was very much put through the ringer in terms of his childhood. He didn't really have one. He was forced to work in order to eat early on. And being a good American, he realized that the hours he was working were not ideal, so he needed to find some other way to make income.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reality of his life certainly fed into the reality of his stories. And when I was talking in the podcast about his stories being honest, I think that he was honest with himself as he wrote them in terms of what is the outcome going to be? It's not always great.
Yeah.
It's not always going to be this like happy ending where everyone, all the good guys win and the bad guys don't, because that was not his life experience.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that he was as honest in his writing as he was about his experiences, and because his experience were real and raw, so were his stories.
Mm. Do we get any sense of his political beliefs? You talked about how he moved very far left, embraced socialism and a lot of the other political fads of the time. Do we see that in any of his writings?
Yeah, he has a few stories that are dystopian, but he didn't write extensively about that.
Okay.
It was something that he liked to debate a lot. And a lot of his friends who did not believe the same things that he did really enjoyed the spirited discussions. Usually he was somewhat inebriated when he was having those, but...
Some of the best discussions are done over.
Totally agree. Yeah. No, but he just really was passionate about what he believed to be right, stemming from his own personal experiences.
Where would he be on kind of the political spectrum today? Obviously on the left, would he be like Bernie Sanders level socialist? Would he have gone further towards Marxism? What would kind of, based on your understanding of his beliefs?
That's a difficult question to answer because I don't know that anyone who would call themselves a socialist in this country would have had the type of life he had.
Okay.
So I think that politically, he would not be like a Bernie Sanders because Bernie Sanders, I'm not trying to get the political, but in terms of his job and his working, he didn't do a lot of that.
Yeah.
So
just factually, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I think that he would share some of the beliefs, but the way that he would interpret those, let's say he was in Congress, which he would never be.
Yeah.
I think that he would not be for some of the bills that like Bernie would try and pass.
Okay. And then not a revolutionary like Che Guevara or anyone like that.
No.
Okay. So his socialism was more born out of the genuine inequities that existed in his time frame before we get the rise of the modern welfare state.
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
And he was very much a product of his experience.
Yeah.
And he leaned into it. Now, what's interesting is within the system that he decried, he was able to rise up above.
Well,
and
that was actually my next question is he achieved certainly a measure of success. Did he become like financially independent through his right? Okay. So that's what I thought he did. Did he continue to advocate for socialism in terms of redistribution of wealth? Or was he more focused on let's solve the genuine inequities in our society he became wealthy?
Yeah, I would lean on he was more interested in solving the genuine inequities in society. He did continue down that pathway after he was rich, but it was something that I think, again, stemmed from his actual life experience of growing up in poverty and not wanting anybody else to go through that.
Yeah.
Believing somehow that the system that he believed in or the system he thought should be implemented would negate or keep something like that from happening to others. I think also, John, there's the reality that when he finally was able to write full-time, he saw that as his purpose.
Mm.
And so he really wanted others to be able to fulfill theirs. And again, he thought that his system of equality was something that would hopefully enable that. Mm-hmm.
So he was concerned for equality, not equity, not righting historic wrongs by taking from those today who have a lot and giving to the descendants of those who didn't have a whole lot.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Jumping back to our discussion 2 weeks ago, actually, how much time did he spend in San Francisco?
His childhood, early adulthood.
Okay, so he was from there. I knew he was from California. I couldn't remember if he was from... Okay, so Star Trek question. Do you remember the episode in which Jack London appears?
Yes,
it is. Okay.
Star Trek, The Next Generation with Mark Twain.
Yes.
Jack London is his protege or somebody who's training under Mark Twain?
He was working as a doorman at a hotel or something like that. Okay, I'm just curious how deep your Star Trek trivia knowledge went. Would you say that we can learn more about, speaking specifically about writers and people who have a large body of their own work available, that we can learn more from their writings than from their lives? Do you see, like...
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you would say that be more of the stereotypical man that is portrayed in Jack London's writings as opposed to the man that he was, or at least try to.
Yeah, I mean, and I would say in that case, it goes beyond just being a man. Like any reader could read these stories and feel the pull of being your own genuine self. Mm-hmm. So doesn't really matter if you're a man or not. It matters that you're the reader and you're projecting your own purpose into the story and adapting what you're learning in that story to your own life.
Right.
What do you garner from this story? Now, if he had written a book about himself, which he kind of did, but not exactly, I mean, I would get less out of that. Mm. I haven't read that one, but I haven't read that one on purpose because I don't really want to.
Interesting.
I want to read more about the adventures that he projects on the page, not about something that could be really close to home. Now, that's not true with all of the authors I read. There are some that I really want to know. It's like, okay, what drove you to write this?
Yeah.
But in his case, I kind of get it, or I think I do, so I would just rather read his stories.
Okay. And on his stories, we think of classics of literature, classics of writing, whether it's novels or plays or whatever it is, from ancient times with the Homeric epics to Shakespeare to modern stuff like Lord of the Rings, Jack London as well. What would you say are the two or three or four or however many you have defining characteristics that says this is a classic work of literature? And does Jack London fit that description?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
And I think that something that comes to mind is the Joseph Campbell book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Mm-hmm. Now that the structure that he talks about, the hero's arc, follows through in almost every story nowadays. But when I'm thinking of classic, where he got this idea of the hero's arc and what happens to the hero and what has to happen over the course of a story came from the idea of a classic. Mm-hmm. It came from Homer. It came from Conrad. It originated from these classical tales, which developed over time. And then Campbell was able to look back and say, okay, this is the prevalent theme I see every single time. Mm-hmm. That's I'll call it a truncated answer, but yeah. that's how I would define a classic, and that's what a lot of stories still try to accomplish.
Can you give us, just for audience members who may not be familiar with Joseph Campbell, what is the hero's arc? Can you give us a little bit more detail on that? Because I heard it described once as a story is set up, or a hero's life is set up, and then it is upset, and then it is reset. I'm curious if that was specific to Campbell and his interpretation, or if that was someone else. I think that was Lewis who said that.
So it's called The Hero's Adventure, and Campbell said that the hero ventures forth from the world of common day into the region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with a power to bestow boons on his fellow man. So yeah, it starts out as somebody who's not anything, has this magical or awesome encounter, becomes something more, encounters that larger challenge, and then returns home a hero. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you give us maybe one or two examples of how we see that in one or two of London's stories?
Yeah, I would say in Call of the Wild, actually, when Buck is this domesticated nobody who is then kidnapped, forced into this work of pulling the dog sled, and then over time bonds with a new master who is then killed, and during this time learns his calling. He wants to be part of this wolf pack. From the beginning, he wasn't anything. Then he became something. Then he was able to share his tale with this wolf pack and become part of that pack.
Jack London was writing at a kind of a unique time in American literary history when it was kind of getting away from more religious and more patriotic themes, kind of in the buildup to the Civil War. After the Civil War, we got more kind of almost like a more grittier, kind of like what we see in Hollywood movies in recent years. Can you tell us a little bit about the specific, like the style of writing and how he portrays specifically the human characters in his books?
Sure. So, I mean, his style was very direct. When you think about how he writes the common man, mm-hmm. very rarely are any of them stupid. They're all pretty straightforward. They're all intelligent to some degree. I mean, even the characters that don't live very long in his stories.
I was going to say, there's one who doesn't make it through a short story.
Yeah. The thing is,
though.
Yeah, no, he's not stupid. He just makes a stupid choice.
Yeah.
And he realizes it right before he dies. So, I mean, a great example is in The Seawolf, Wolf Larsen, the captain of the ship, who's the bad guy in the story.
Mm-hmm.
He is someone who is very intelligent. He's very smart, and he considers it kind of a curse that he knows so much. He doesn't brag about how much he knows, but
right.
he's very aware. So he is powerful, he's strong, he's tall, he's exceedingly smart. That's an example of one of the things that comes through in his writing is in his experiences. Even his drunken friends, they weren't dumb. All of these people that he was around were alive. They were able to stay alive in this terrible environment.
Yeah.
And some of them thrived. That takes a level of intelligence, not just survival instincts. So he's taking his actual life experience and saying, okay, I know that there's this preoccupation with the idea that somebody who shovels coal may not be smart, but actually they are.
Yeah.
They've made a choice to do what they're doing, or they find themselves in a circumstance over which they have very little control, which was him several times.
Yeah.
But that doesn't negate the intelligence, or it doesn't change how smart they are, or if put into a more complicated environment, how much they would be able to thrive.
Yeah.
And that was his experience.
Hmm. Do you think that part of that kind of more gritty, raw characterization came from the fact that his personal life for most of his adult life was a bit of a train wreck?
Yeah, it was.
That might be a bit excessive, but he had some challenges.
He did. A light that burns twice as bright burns half as long.
Yeah.
And I think that was certainly his. And I'm not going to try and classify alcoholism as a way to burn brightly. It's not. It's actually the exact opposite. But there were many other things that he did or conditions that he subjected himself to that he lived. Those were living. I mean, those were experiences where you felt alive, but they were high stress. Mm-hmm. They were very much taxing on the body. And so I think that all of that went into the writing as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that part of that, John, is the stemming from his personal life beyond drinking. So he was married twice.
Mm-hmm.
His first wife, he wasn't in love with. It was more of it was not an arranged marriage, but it was something that he felt he was supposed to do. And he made it very clear to her, and she made it clear to him that she did not approve of how he lived at all. So it was...
Why would they get married at that? Was she pregnant? Was that...
He just felt like that was something he was supposed to. He was supposed
Why?
To have kids.
Okay.
So they had two kids together.
Yeah.
And then they separated. She was very much a rule follower. He was not, obviously.
Right.
They both had an understanding of what the marriage was.
Hmm.
I consider that very sad, but it was more of a practical thing at that point in his life. His second marriage was a lot more wild. It was certainly a lot more. I think with that comes a level of stress that's not planned for at the beginning.
I would imagine.
Yeah, a lot of spontaneity in the marriage, so to speak. And I think that carried over into his personal life beyond that. Like when he actually decided to start to settle down and to build a house, there's speculation. Could be completely wrong,
mm-hmm.
but there's speculation that as a result of some of the spontaneity in their marriage, I'll call it.
I'm curious what you mean. You've used that word several times, Joe. What exactly, for our audience, keeping it PG, what do you mean by spontaneity?
They were both very active in their lives outside of their marriage.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was having a very, very nice house built on the property. There's some suspicion that the fire that consumed it was on purpose.
Really?
Not totally sure on that.
One of his wife's friends, or
it may have been her.
You
know, that's what some
really?
Have said. Yeah.
Oh.
So if you go to
gentlemen,
his property,
there's a lesson. Don't take off your wives.
Yeah. So if there, you can actually go to his property now and see the bones of that house. Yeah, it's still there. Yes, that burning bright light is shining well, but it has the tendency to consume a lot.
Hmm.
So there was that added stress there for sure.
Okay. All right, and to close this out, Jack London is not particularly well known these days, which is, I think, really tragic because
tragic.
He has some amazing stories. Could you give our audience, especially parents, maybe some insight, some advice? Which of these stories would be appropriate to children? Maybe to read to your kids as they're going to bed, or read to them at some point. Obviously, trying to keep it age appropriate. Can you share some insights? And were you read any of Jack London's stories when you were a child?
So it's interesting. Any parent who wants to read these stories to their kids, I encourage that greatly because they are real. They're honest. Not every story has a happy ending. And sometimes the reality of the life of these characters brings an opportunity for a longer discussion about what drove that person to do that. What was the result of that ending? Like what occurred afterward and so on. So just be prepared for conversation afterward. I think every young kid should read Call of the Wild. I think that every young kid should read White Fang. Those are classics. They're fun and they're inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
So those are easy ones. The ones I've been rambling on about are more of the ones that have harder parts or harder endings.
Yeah.
I will say that the story that I referenced in the podcast, A Thousand Dozen Eggs, was read to me when I was 14. That was that was the first time I'd ever been read a bedtime story. I had a very close family friend and mentor who I was staying over at their house that night. We were going to go to church the following day. And I saw him reading a book, and I was like, hey, what are you reading? And he said, he told me this story, and he said, you know what? I'm going to start over. I'm going to read it to you. So he's read it, the whole thing. And I remember it was snowing outside that night. And like I said in the podcast, even though we were inside, because of the story, I could feel the cold. Mm-hmm. As he read it, it was so vivid. And I cared so much for this character. I was so excited for this character. I was so pumped that he was going to get the thing that he so desperately wanted. And without giving a whole lot more away, something happens. And I remember sitting there after it was done, it just ended. And my mentor just kind of sat there. He said, do you have any questions? That's why I'm saying be prepared for conversation, because I did have some. That was not my favorite ending. why did that happen? Why was he so excited about this thing he was doing? Did this thing happen in the past? Did this happen a lot in the Klondike? You know, what's the meaning of life? You know, all those different things came up as a result of reading that story or hearing that story read to me. So that's where the power is that you have this opportunity, whether you're reading the story to your kids or they're reading it and they come to you with questions, or you're an adult and you go back and you discover the stories for the first time and you start to question, am I fulfilling my purpose right now as a result of the tales that he tells? And thinking about all of that, it's not just the power of London, it's the power of story in general.
Before we say goodbye, one quick note. Next week will be our season wrap-up. We'll be talking about some of the major themes that we learned, some of the people that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but were on our list of candidates for the biographies. So be sure you check us out next week. Also, if you have questions about any of the episodes, any of the topics, anything that we talked about this season, please send those questions to us by Friday, May 27th, so that we can answer them and you can be a part of our discussion. Again, we love getting those questions, so the more the merrier. Send them to our email address at 15minutehistory@gmail.com or send them to us on Facebook.
As our season comes to a close, we will be doing episodes over the summer break. For our first one, we had the great opportunity to sit down with an eminent British historian and author. We cannot wait to share that interview with you and look forward to doing so.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Jack London. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Please leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. And if you want to help us make it even better, go to our website, 15minutehistorypodcast.org, and click the support button. Thanks, and see you next week.